This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. My co-host Tim Stenovic is off in what was another eventful week for investors. No summer doldrums, for sure. Now, the big economic news of our week, something we addressed with many of our guests, the latest CPI and PPI prints, both headline and core, coming in better than expected in the month of July. Even so, with a still hot headline inflation reading on CPI of 8.5% year over year, Fed officials are expected to continue on a path of raising interest rates. Also this week, a major legislative policy initiative, $437 billion to bring down America's deficit, healthcare costs, and carbon emissions. Ahead on our broadcast, we catch up with the CEO of Plug Power on what it all means for key climate change initiatives and the company's business in green hydrogen. We'll also hear from the head of H&R Block on the health of the American consumer and the company's blistering share price gains, plus the CEO of Trivago on the persistently high cost of travel and the outlook for the hospitality industry. All of that to come. We begin with today's sobering reality of the world's worsening climate conditions. A Bloomberg Big Take this week explains how, from the Rhine to the Danube, Europe's rivers are drying up as temperatures post record highs across the continent, disrupting trade, commerce, and more. Bloomberg's Mike Regan and I spoke with Bloomberg News oil products reporter Jack Whittles to help us understand the crisis across the Atlantic.
It is really hot in Europe. It's been a very hot summer, and as a result, a lot of river levels are extremely low. Probably the most important of them is a river called the Rhine. That's about 800 miles long. It starts in the Swiss Alps. It goes all the way down through Europe to the North Sea, and that is used to ship a lot of really important commodities through the continent. So I'm talking energy, coal, gas oil, diesel, gasoline, but also stuff like gravel, cement, iron ore. When the water level on the Rhine gets really low, the barges that are used to transport all this stuff, they can't take on enough. They can't take on their full loads of these commodities because the more you load, the lower you get in the water. And then when the river's really shallow, they'll hit the bottom. So the low water is really choking off the supply of energy and commodities in Europe. Just as there's a war in Ukraine and we've got problems with Russian gas supply, so it's all a bit of a perfect storm at the moment.
You know, Jack, this strikes me as a very difficult problem to solve, save doing a rain dance or something. I don't know how you fix this. So I'm wondering, is there any hope that this problem can be solved, or is it more a matter of, shipping stuff via truck and rail instead? How are people dealing with this?
There aren't many very easy short-term solutions for companies. You can use rail, you can use road. So, Switzerland, for instance, imports some oil products via the Rhine, but it does also get through road and rail and pipeline, I believe. Companies can do that, but it's much more expensive. So that's not always great. The economics are not always going to look very good on that. The other thing companies can do is they can invest in ships that are specifically designed to go in shallow water. So BASF, the chemicals company, they've invested in a couple of ships to do that. But it's not easy. And with climate change, I personally think it's probably just going to get worse and worse, to be honest.
Well, and that's where I want to go, because this wouldn't be happening. Is it fair for me to make this jump if it wasn't for climate change?
Right. The Rhine is fed by a combination of rain and melting glaciers. And the more the lower and lower the glaciers get, then the less they can feed the Rhine. I'm not a climate scientist, so I'm not going to try and say this specific event was pinned down to climate change. But in general, that's the way it's going, and I can only see it getting worse, really.
Right, those alpine glaciers, right? They feed into all of this, and we know kind of to some extent maybe some of that's, it, you know, going away.
Yeah, they're getting smaller. Yeah, they're getting smaller and smaller, yeah.
Jack, I'm wondering where we should look for this crisis to sort of have the most potential damage. You know, is it a matter of BMW, Mercedes not being able to produce cars at some point because they can't get supplies? Or is it there's something more acute, you know, like electricity going off in Germany? Where will this really start to cause the most problems?
Well, as an energy reporter, I'm convinced it is in the energy world.
Right.
The last of what you were saying. Switzerland, for instance, it's already said it's releasing oil from its strategic reserves. Austria and Hungary, which are in that sort of general neck of the woods, they've also said in recent months that they're doing the same. You've had some refinery outages in those areas as well. The diesel market in Europe is already very tight, and we are going to lose, well, in theory, the EU is going to lose supply from Russia in February as well with the EU sanctions. So on oil, it's tight. You know, then on power as well. Uniper has warned it may have to cut output at two key coal-fired power plants in Germany because the company is struggling to get fuel supplies along the Rhine. So getting that coal in to Germany to make the power, just as the gas gets cut off from Russia, that's another sort of more immediate crisis.
You know, Jack, is this sort of fueling the whole debate about alternative energy in Europe and especially Germany? Are people reconsidering nuclear more aggressively because of this and everything else going on in the world?
I strongly imagine so. You know, I was talking to one of my energy contacts recently, and he was saying he was sort of criticizing Germany's decision actually to shut off its nuclear capacity, you know, saying what a crazy time to do that. And so I think this will certainly spur the argument in general about renewables doing it faster, because nobody in Europe wants to be reliant on fossil fuels, because you're at the mercy of other countries and you're at the mercy of this sort of infrastructure that doesn't always hold up well under climate change.
That was Bloomberg News oil products reporter Jack Whittles and Bloomberg's Mike Regan. Coming up, more on climate change as it and America's energy transition gets a big boost from Congress. The CEO of Plug Power on the importance of growing green hydrogen. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Well, our next guest we last caught up with back in June, and so much has happened since then, including key tax, climate, and healthcare policies, which Democrats call the largest investment in fighting climate change ever made in the United States. Shares in the alternative energy space rallied on the news this week. That includes the stock of Plug Power, which is up more than 100% since mid-May. Andy Marsh is the president and CEO of Plug Power, and Bloomberg Markets' Mike Regan and I talked with him about the potential impact of new congressional climate and alternative energy initiatives. We began, though, with the company's earnings release out this past week.
The market was excited about Plug for a few reasons. We have an electrolyzer business which takes, you know, green electricity to produce green hydrogen. Before even the announcements of the production tax credit for green hydrogen, we have seen bookings 50% higher for the year than we expected for the whole year. We've done 1.5 gigawatts. That excited the market. I think the second item that excited the market is that, you know, our path to $3 billion in 2025 and 17% OI, you know, even becomes brighter when you include the production tax credit that was passed. And I think on top of that, we were able to reiterate guidance for this year. And I think that made investors comfortable with the direction the company's taken.
Andy, I'm wondering, is there any visibility on when you think Plug Power will turn to profitability, either on a quarterly, annual basis, next few years, or any sense on that?
Sure. Our CFO is very clear in pronouncing that the company would be profitable in 2024.
What's it take to get there? What is it, just a matter of reducing R&D and that sort of thing, and seeing some of these projects just start to bring in the revenue?
Oh, I would never reduce R&D. This industry is just starting, Mike.
Yeah.
Where it's coming from is the build out of our green hydrogen network across the United States. We have first mover advantage. We'll have 500 tons deployed per day by 2025 in the States, 70 tons by the end of this year. It dramatically impacts our cost of fuel, which really is one of the big items in keeping us from being profitable. And we're becoming vertically integrated to make sure that we're providing it to ourselves cost effectively. And that's really one of the big items that changes our income statement.
How do you in terms of hydrogen and how much does it continue to be a part of our energy society?
Hydrogen ultimately, and Carol, these are not my numbers. These are numbers like your organization, Bloomberg,
mm-hmm.
thinks this will be 20% of world's energy by 2050. And it's growing from now. Now, if you take a look at Walmart, where we announced a 30 tons per day green hydrogen agreement with them, that is helping them on their path to reduce their carbon footprint by 1 gigaton. So the real work is happening now, and certainly the bill that Senator Schumer and Senator Manchin were instrumental in having passed will just accelerate this move in the world to a green economy.
Yeah, Andy, I wanted to ask you about that. How does hydrogen in general and Plug Power specifically sort of fit into this Inflation Reduction Act, which has so many perks for green energy? And on top of that, is there a risk, in the midterms of some of that being undone?
Well, I think that I'm going to answer your last question first. When there was an investment tax credit for fuel cells, actually the House bill had more Republican co-signers and Democrat co-signers. I've met with people like Senator Cassidy from Louisiana. They are strong supporters of hydrogen. This act that, it's obviously Senator Schumer and Manchin, who are both huge supporters, has a $3 production tax credit for green hydrogen, which makes hydrogen from green sources competitive with any other form of hydrogen. It's a big deal. Because the market for hydrogen is large today from natural gas. Now we're lower cost and competitive with natural gas hydrogen today. It helps our electrolyzer business. It helps our fuel cell business because it'll be able to drive all sorts of applications, like the backup power system we developed for Microsoft, which makes fuel cost effective with today's diesel.
And green hydrogen, I mean, just remind everybody, you're using it, but this is hydrogen power that's generated by renewables, right? Whether it's wind, yeah. Whether it's solar.
Or hydropower. I mean, one of my favorite plants is the one we're building in New York. And just like George Westinghouse built the first electrical network using Niagara Falls power, we're using Niagara Falls power to create green hydrogen.
What is the biggest thing that's holding back green hydrogen right now?
Well, I think the biggest, the Senate will be the big accelerator for this market. And I think they put us in a position where green hydrogen will now be cost competitive. And it's our responsibility to make sure that we leverage this time like they did in solar and wind so that the cost of green hydrogen will always be lower with or without government support in the long run.
Andy, it's interesting. In addition to the top line and bottom line of your company, which is obviously very important, but we've also got a planet to consider here. And I'm wondering, how optimistic are you about everything that's been done by Congress and about the future of the hydrogen power industry to really help save the world, help reduce this climate damage that is really starting to come to roost now with all these weather anomalies and everything? Is there reason to be optimistic about the climate going forward, given all these developments this year?
Absolutely, Mike. Let me tell you, I worked in wireless in 1983 when nobody knew what wireless was. And I've seen creation of industries. And this bill by Congress is good for the national security of the United States. It's good for climate change. It's good for creating jobs. And it will create momentum with customers like Amazon who want to be carbon, you know, or looking to be carbon neutral by 2040. It's good for customers like Microsoft, which want to eliminate diesel from their process. This bill will help make it happen. And it actually puts the United States in a unique leadership position. So I think the kids running around in 2050 are going to be really happy with what the Senate did in 2022.
That was Andy Marsh, President and CEO of Plug Power. Coming up next, a new app aims to help users have an understanding of what it's like to work at a Wall Street hedge fund without the risk. Find out how and why. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York. To Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991. To Boston, Bloomberg 1061. To San Francisco, Bloomberg 960. To the country, Sirius XM Channel 119. And around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
Meritus is a company and app founded by two Wall Street veterans. It aims to democratize Wall Street recruiting and more. The platform simulates the experience of working at a fast-paced hedge fund on your mobile device. To find out how, Bloomberg's Mike Regan and I caught up with the company's founder and CEO, Neil Dotta.
My background is I've been an institutional allocator to hedge funds for the last 15 years, really having exposure to some of the most well-known, best-performing hedge fund managers in the space. And you know, over the course of that time, you know, it became abundantly obvious that the folks that are in the position of making investment decisions and managing money for folks that are, you know, whether they're firemen or police officers or institutional investors like myself, it's not necessarily the people that have the most talent, but a lot of times it's the folks that had the best resumes and found themselves in the position to manage that capital. And really what we wanted to do with Meritas was to kind of create a platform that democratizes this access that forever has been limited to folks who have specific resumes, came to specific schools. So that's the platform in a nutshell. And really what we do is we extend this access to folks regardless of their ability to finance their trading or their actual education. So it's a free app that you download that allows you to simulate working at a hedge fund and trading equities and crypto, and your experience generates an alpha score. And we take that alpha score and we allow you to apply for jobs on Wall Street with that score. So it's really bringing that experience to everyone through their mobile devices. And one thing that was kind of you know, really obvious to me was that, you know, for I've been managing large pools of capital and my co-founder Gabriel as well. And we realize that even at the scale and scope that we invest, even ourselves, we don't actually own our own track record. And this is what we think we should do to everyone and give everyone the opportunity to, you know, whether you're a junior analyst at a bank and you want to leverage your experience, most of the time your employer owns your actual ideas. And we give folks like that an ability to say, hey, this is why I'm talented. and this is why you should hire me based upon my talent, not what based on my resume says.
Let me make sure I'm picturing this right. So I log in and I basically can start doing some paper trading, and you'll be able to track my P&L, sort of rank me among other traders. What happens if, say, my strategy is some algorithm, you know, fast twitch type of thing? Am I able to sort of input a automated strategy into this thing as well?
That's a great question. And the answer is no, actually. And we take the view that being allocators into these strategies, so I know the folks that you can think of that are kind of at the forefront of high frequency and systematic trading, we take the view that it's very difficult for a typical person to compete against a big $10 billion hedge fund. So really, we're meant for fundamental investing. We're meant for people that do, you know, research on individual companies and take views on things like market share and earnings and growth potential. We're not focused on kind of day trading or systematic trading, because the thinking is that that's not a game that a typical person can succeed at.
Yeah, so Neil, I'm wondering how Meritas makes money off of this. It is a free app. I'm guessing the users, the traders get to use it for free, and then maybe the hedge funds pay for access to see who's doing what?
Yeah, exactly. So we're effectively a recruiting platform. So the way I like to think of us is we're kind of like the NCAA for Wall Street, where you join our platform, you showcase your skills, and if your skills happen to match an employer who finds that valuable, then they'll reach out to you directly, and then we'll get paid on the recruiting fee that the employer will pay us.
Hey, Neil, how does this maybe help create more diversity when it comes to financial firms, hedge funds specifically? Because that is certainly something we've talked about a lot over the last couple of years. And while there's progress being made, there's a long way to go. So how might what you guys are doing help with that? Can you make it kind of colorblind, sex blind, like can you, or gender blind? Can you do that so that we maybe up the diversity ante?
Sure, great question. And if you think of the way recruiting is done at hedge funds and big banks, it really hasn't changed in the last 100 years. It's effectively a network of who you know and how well you're connected. And those are the metrics that typically place people, particularly in most highest income roles like portfolio manager and analyst. So we take the view that it should be a democratized system that should be based solely on your talent. So through us, we don't care what you look like. We don't care what your resume says. We don't even care where you went to school. Right. We only care about your ideas. And those ideas can potentially get you paid or get you recruited.
Our big thanks to Neil Dotta, the founder and CEO of Meritas. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Still to come, we're talking planes, trains, and automobiles. Well, we're really talking about getting out and about. The CEOs of CarParts.com and travel services company Trivago are up next. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Earlier, we heard about Europe's worsening climate situation and America's hopes for an expedited transition to clean energy. A large part of that effort will come from the auto industry. A recent report from the Bloomberg NEF says we are just 14 years away from peak car, when an estimated 1.5 billion passenger vehicles globally are expected on the road by 2039. Well, before we get there, buyers, you know this, they're still looking at months, perhaps even years worth of inflation and supply chain snarls that could hinder them from getting the cars they want and when they want them. That's where CarParts.com comes in. Bloomberg News senior markets reporter Katie Greifeld and I asked CEO David Meignan how his company can help.
CarParts.com, we're a direct-to-consumer, pure-play online player of auto parts and accessories. We've been in business for 25 years, and what makes us very unique is that we have a vertically integrated supply chain. So we buy our own parts from globally, a combination of collision parts and replacement parts, and then we sell them direct to consumer via our own distribution channel. So we're in a very good spot to see what's going on in the auto world and the auto parts industry. You know, the auto industry is just gigantic. You guys know that. You cover it all the time. Auto parts is $300 billion market. And believe it or not, the average age of a car on the road is 12.2 years. So the average American drives an older car. And in order to keep that car going and running longer, they rely on retailers like us to buy, you know, quality parts at competitive prices.
You know, David, during the last couple of years, we heard so much about how the actual automakers were struggling to source the chips they need and other parts. I'm curious how you guys fared with all the supply chain disruptions we've had. I can only imagine it must have been a giant headache. Was it tough to source the parts you needed in the last few years?
I mean, supply chain was basically top of mind for the last 2 years, right? Before inflation and Ukraine and everything else. You know, we were very aggressive early on in the pandemic in ramping up inventory buys. You know, we've built capabilities in-house. So we increased the quantities of our buy. We increased our safety stock requirements. We opened more distribution centers just to carry more inventory. What we found was it took longer and it was more complicated to get the parts. So in order to keep going and to keep growing, we just had to carry more inventory. And so if you look at it from a financial investor perspective, we basically had to sacrifice inventory turns just to make sure that we had the parts in stock.
And of course, the other big shock this year is inflation. And I'm wondering how that plays into your business. I mean, does it sort of cause this effect where consumers are maybe more willing to try to work on their own car and find those parts on your site? Or how's the price problems we've seen this year sort of translating into your everyday business?
Yeah, absolutely. And historically, auto parts and auto repair in general is pretty inflation resistant. You know, if you need a car, if you're a school teacher or a nurse and you need your car to get to work, you're going to have to do what you need to do to keep it going. So obviously, for every retailer and for all the consumers out there, inflation is hitting everyone. And we're not immune. You know, what we had to do was really kind of make sure that we found efficiencies in the supply chain to be able to pass on our savings of that, you know, direct to consumer, factory to consumer, to the consumer. Having said that, you know, you're absolutely right in terms of inflation. What it does is that if historically you were do it for me and needed a friend or a mechanic to do the repair, chances are you're going to go on YouTube or on Google and figure out a way to source the parts and do it cheaper.
All my friends are on YouTube these days trying to figure out how to fix their car. It's amazing. I had to go on YouTube to find out how to change the tire in my Jeep Cherokee. I'm not too embarrassed to admit. YouTube is creating a lot of mechanics, I have a feeling, David.
I'm sure you saved a lot of money, but you're absolutely right. YouTube is creating a lot of mechanics. And ultimately, if you want to do the labor yourself and you could find that 10 or 15 minute video, you know, companies like us, we're a good alternative because, you know, you can get the parts for 50% cheaper than in the store.
You said you built up inventory. Does that mean you're going to be working down inventory and maybe not demanding or buying so much from your suppliers over the next few months?
That is a great question. And the answer is yes. We're seeing some signs of easing up in the supply chain. So as the lead times start compressing, we have to carry less safety stock or buffer inventory. And what you're going to see from us, and I'm assuming other companies out there, is converting that inventory back to cash and seeing some working capital improvements.
Okay. Speaking of working capital, and I'm just reading off of your press release, you guys have you entered into an amended and restated $75 million credit facility, the ability to increase to $150 million. Are you looking to get hold of whatever cash you get? Because it's, you know, you're concerned about maybe what the environment might be. And I don't know, a few months, it might be a tougher environment.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a lot of signs that the economic environment is getting tougher. Having said that, you know, we're growing, we're profitable. We have positive unit economics on every transaction. We have no debt and we're well funded and well capitalized. So, you know, that line of credit is just a safety net that we basically don't need.
That was CarParts.com. CEO David Mignon, Katie Greifeld with us there as well. Now, declining gas prices were a big reason for July's cooler than expected inflation reading. One area that is still seeing costs soar, the travel and hospitality sector. For insight into how those pressures might persist, Bloomberg's Mike Regan and I spoke with Trivago CEO Axel Hefer.
The industry is at an interesting point where it's benefiting from a lot of pent-up demand and a lot of money that has been saved over the last couple of years by not doing trips, by not going out during lockdowns, etc. At the same time, the industry has actually reduced staffing levels quite a bit in the pandemic. Everybody had to, and is now struggling to staff up. So there is a lot more demand than there is supply, and that's exactly what you're describing. The service is actually suffering from that. And that's why we are more cautious on the outlook, and we think that this imbalance will start to balance again, which means that the prices will continue to go up and demand will come down.
Yeah, Axel, you know, you can't talk to someone from Bloomberg for more than about 30 seconds without getting an question about inflation this week. So I'm curious, you know, is inflation having any sort of ripple effects in the travel industry? Is it changing behavior at all or anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, I don't think we see it yet because what we've seen in the last couple of years is that the summer vacation is actually the key thing. I mean, even in the pandemic, you want to make sure that you get a break with your family, with your friends for a couple of days. So I don't think that, the summer period is necessarily representative, but we see it in all our main markets. Inflation is hitting the disposable income of many, many people. And what that means is that they will need to think twice how to spend their money and how to get the best vacation possible. And in travel is actually different than a lot of other sectors. You have quite a few choices. You can decide whether you spend money on air tickets or whether you go by car. So the destinations are your choice. Destinations are very differently priced. You can go for different kind of accommodation and you can compare prices, which is actually why we are actually looking into the future quite positively. People being more price conscious means that they will spend more time on researching prices, and that's exactly where we're helping them.
Well, that's, you know, you guys have access to so much data. What kind of, you know, talk to us about that, you know, consumers are searching, looking for the best deal. What other trends are you noting when it comes to travel at this point?
Yeah, I mean, you have overall, obviously, higher prices. Prices have gone up quite a bit. Not every destination to the same extent. And you have a couple of fun anecdotes that just support what you're describing. I mean, for example, searches for hotels close to the airport in the UK have doubled compared to 2019, because now you don't know whether you have to show up 2 hours before, 4 hours before, 5 hours before, because of the lack of staffing. So a lot of people decide to just stay overnight. So that's what you see already. But I think what we will see over the next 12 months is more a fundamental change in really saving costs, because the summer vacation that people are now on, they have made up their mind to do that trip quite a while back, and the inflation has got a lot of worse over the last couple of months.
Axel, I'm curious what the story is with business travel. As Carol said, she's jet-setting all over the place for work. They don't let me out of the office. But is Carol an anomaly? I don't get the impression that business travel is quite back where it was.
Yeah, I mean, so we are not really big in business travel, to be honest. And the sad but true thing is that a lot of business travelers don't really care as much how much they are spending on their accommodation because the employer is paying. So we have a few business travelers that tend to be, you know, self-employed, SMEs, etc. That's why we don't have the best visibility. But our expectation for the overall market is that with the economy slowing down, that the not essential business travel will come down. And there was also a bit of a catch-up effect. You hadn't seen business partners in 2 or 3 years.
That was Axel Hefer, the CEO of Trivago. And that wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Masser. Ahead in our next hour, the CEO of H&R Block gives us an update on the American consumer and small business, both key to the U.S. economy. He also weighs in on his company's red-hot stock price. Plus, why Mark Zuckerberg wants you to think of Facebook as a social media underdog. Wait, what? And also coming up next, we turn back to this week's special double issue of Bloomberg Business Week. It's all about why American women are at their breaking point. One story on that looks at what the end of Roe versus Wade could mean for access to IVF treatments. That story's coming up. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week, including the CEO of H&R Block and how new policy moves might impact taxpayers, as well as the agency that collects our cash, the IRS. Plus, why Mark Zuckerberg is hitting the panic button, even as Facebook rakes in billions of dollars. And we've also got the upside of internet and app addictions with the author, lecturer, and investor known in Silicon Valley as the Habits Guy. First up this hour, the latest edition of Bloomberg Business Week magazine. It's a special double issue that takes a look at the dwindling support for women's rights and resources in America. One area of concern in the wake of the Supreme Court's reversal of Roe v. Wade involves fertility treatments. Bloomberg contributor Jill Filipovich breaks down the new threat to in vitro fertilization access with my co-host Tim Stenovic and Bloomberg's Katie Greifeld.
As it stands, IVF remains legal in all 50 states in the U.S., with some restrictions depending on the state. However, with Roe falling, you're seeing a real push from the Right to Life movement to establish essentially fetal and embryonic personhood. And if personhood bills pass, which essentially imbue a fertilized egg from the moment of fertilization with full rights, due process rights, and certainly a right to life, you're going to see IVF become either extremely difficult, if not potentially criminal. And that's because IVF procedures typically result in the creation of multiple embryos, and the embryos that are not viable are discarded. Embryos that don't form a successful pregnancy or can't form a successful pregnancy will be discarded. And couples often create more embryos than they actually implant at one time and then store those embryos for future use. If those embryos have full rights, you can see how that would get quite legally complicated.
IVF, it's all about creating more life. It's about, you know, creating a baby for a couple to have. But I mean, I guess that's the crux of the issue is that, you know, these embryos, theoretically, under this vision, they would be people. They would have those rights that you're talking about.
Right, exactly. And so there's a question of whether that would necessarily make IVF illegal or whether it would just make the legal landscape so dangerous and so complicated that providers essentially wouldn't want to practice. So, for example, part of what happens in IVF is if you create multiple embryos, those embryos go into a storage facility and they're frozen. And if you want to use one later on, you defrost it, essentially, and you have an embryologist who defrosts that embryo. Most embryos survive that process. Some don't. If an embryo has full personhood rights and it doesn't survive the process, embryologists could become legally liable, potentially criminally liable, and certainly potentially civilly liable. And so there's real questions about whether anyone is going to want to practice IVF under those conditions.
What did you hear from Elizabeth, which we should note is a pseudonym? Tell us her story.
Elizabeth is a woman who lives in New Orleans. She has one daughter who was conceived through IVF after two grueling years of infertility. And Elizabeth and her husband both want a second child, but they weren't planning on starting that process for at least a few more months and potentially into next year. When the Supreme Court decision in Dobbs overturning Roe v. Wade came down, Elizabeth and her husband decided to pretty significantly move up their plans for a second child. So she made an appointment right away at the fertility clinic that she had used previously. She, when I met her, was already taking hormones to prepare her body for an embryo transfer. And then the night before I met Elizabeth, she was actually kind of reeling when I talked to her because her husband had turned to her in bed and essentially said, "I'm really nervous about you being pregnant in this environment." I think both of them have been reading many of the horror stories that have come out post-Roe of women who weren't appropriately treated for ectopic pregnancies, who weren't appropriately treated for miscarriages. You know, and her husband said, you're a woman in your mid-30s. This is an IVF pregnancy. It's going to be a high-risk pregnancy. I don't want to lose you. And so the couple is now struggling with that question. Do they stick with just one child? Do they speed up the IVF process because they're afraid that they won't have the ability to do it later? But in doing so, do they potentially risk Elizabeth's life? And these are questions couples all over the U.S., women all over the U.S. are asking themselves.
And just impossible questions. And Jill, put this into context for us about, you know, how common IVF is. How many people like Elizabeth could be out there in the U.S. right now?
IVF is incredibly common. And to be clear, while IVF is the fertility treatment most at risk, it's not the only fertility treatment available, and it's not the only one put at risk by new anti-abortion laws. Right now, roughly 2 of every 100 children born in the U.S. Were conceived via some sort of fertility treatment. So that includes IVF, but also a series of others. And IVF is particularly crucial to same-sex couples. It's crucial to couples who have, or individuals who have survived cancer, and then obviously anyone struggling with infertility. And it's only growing as more and more women delay childbearing and want to plan when they have children.
Where does this leave providers, Jill?
Providers that I've spoken to, including the providers I spoke to for this piece, really are in, frankly, a bit of a panic. A lot of their work has been thrown into question. They can provide care right now. Many of them are consulting with lawyers pretty regularly. But yes, it does open up questions.
And if you haven't picked up the double issue of Bloomberg Business Week or checked it out online, definitely do so. You can find it at Bloomberg.com/businessweek on the Bloomberg terminal and on newsstands. Really a must read. Our thanks to Bloomberg contributor Jill Filipovich for her story and for talking about it with my co-host Tim Stenovic and Bloomberg's Katie Greifeld. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Coming up, taxes, boring. H&R Block's record share price, not so boring. The CEO joins us on the other side. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
This past week, the company best known for tax prep, H&R Block, reported a beat, raised some guidance for fiscal 2023, and approved a new share buyback of $1.25 billion. Jeff Jones is president and CEO of the company, and we like to remind everyone that Jeff has spent his career at a host of well-known companies. That includes as chief marketing officer at The Gap and Target, and also president of ride-sharing over at Uber. Now he is shepherding H&R Block to its next era. Bloomberg's Mike Regan and I asked him how he's doing it.
Well, let's start with, you know, our bread and butter, the core consumer tax business. You know, we continue to make improvements in revenue, in client volume, in market share in our assisted business, really demonstrating just how strong that industry is. You know, we talked about going into the pandemic in 19, coming out in 22, up in revenue, up in market share, up in earnings, reducing shares outstanding. So the core consumer tax business has been very strong. We had a record year in small business. And so that means more and more small business owners are recognizing our expertise and turning to us for tax. And then we had a really successful initial launch of Spruce, which is our new challenger bank.
You know, Jeff, the big news in politics this week, obviously, is that Inflation Reduction Act. Part of that is they want to add thousands and thousands of IRS agents. I've got to think that's a very big opportunity for you, but also potentially a challenge. I'm just curious how you're thinking about the ramp up of the IRS enforcement.
Well, we have been very vocal in support of the IRS receiving more funding. You know, they touch more American consumers than any other agency, and they have not had the resources to be equipped to do that. So we absolutely support that. And what we've seen, I guess, over history is when the IRS steps up enforcement, the consumer looks for expertise more and more. You know, keep in mind, the stakes for our clients are very high. Getting this right matters. Getting every dollar they deserve matters, whether you're a small business owner, a gig worker, or a consumer. And so, you know, we're glad they're getting more support, and we're here to help the customer.
You know, your core business is the tax services, but you are expanding in small business. You mentioned Spruce, your mobile banking. What kind of growth are we seeing on those platforms? And do you anticipate that there is a time where they are as equally as important as your core tax business?
Well, there's no question they're strategically as important today. Of course, they're earlier stage. We've been in the tax business for decades. Mm-hmm. In small business, we had a record year. We grew that business clients 5% on top of 4% last year and believe there's still lots of upside in serving small businesses. Just looking at the landscape, those people that have side hustles, 1099s, gig workers, they may not consider themselves to be a small business owner, but they absolutely have tax and bookkeeping, potentially payroll needs, just like a small business would. And then with Spruce, we had a fantastic launch. That product has been in the market only a handful of months. We've had 7 major releases of the app since we launched. And right now the team is focused on testing customer acquisition outside of tax season, and then getting ready to launch it in our retail channel next tax season. Obviously, we have a very large install base of customers, and we want to take full advantage of introducing them to Spruce next year.
Jeff, what's cool about talking to you, you talk about small business. You know, it's funny, our colleague on television, Caroline Hyde, she talked about the small cap, the Russell doing really well and outperforming the broader market. And a lot of that has to play with kind of domestic businesses here in the U.S., maybe upbeat about the outlook in the economy. So I love hearing what you have to say about small business. I love hearing about Spruce because you get some insight into consumers and really kind of maybe how much money they've been able to save and so on and so forth. Based on what you are seeing, based on your business overall, would you say, yep, we are headed for a recession in the next year, or we're not?
If I just had to simply call it, I would say we're not. But like you all do as well, I mean, we're looking at the same data. There are days to be optimistic, and then the next day you need to be cautious.
What is it that maybe troubles you a little bit? Is there some concern about the Fed overdoing it and putting some slow momentum ultimately into the economy?
Part of our diversification is to participate in different parts of the market. In the tax business, you know, that business over many, many decades has not been sensitive to recession,
right,
because of the obligation we have as American filers. In fact, when economic times get tough, the stakes rise. That's when our expertise and value really kick in. So obviously we have to execute and continue to build on the momentum we have, but that business looks different than, for example, in our financial products portfolio, where, you know, if savings rates are lower and maybe credit is starting to rise again and every dollar matters and government subsidies are gone, then what we have to do with Spruce is make sure people know that product is a almost completely fee-free product that offers incredible value to help you spend and save and plan. And so we try to lean into how our value proposition is helping consumers, because we know that every dollar really matters.
How do you think about how to return that share, that capital to shareholders? Is it best to do a little bit of each, like you're doing, or, you know, what's the calculus that goes into deciding how to do that?
Well, Mike, I guess I'd also say the first part is investing in our business,
right?
Which we are absolutely doing. Now, we're able to still generate significant free cash flow to invest in dividends and share repurchase because of our expense management discipline. If you think about on a given year, think, you know, roughly a couple hundred million dollars to continue to invest in our dividend, and the rest, $200 to $300 million, is in share buyback. So because of the profitability of this business, I think we're in a unique position to be able to really do all three at an effective way.
As you guys have been broadening out, expanding services, I mean, part of it is so that you can kind of, you know, not be, see so much of kind of positive results or so much business momentum kind of during tax season, right? So are you seeing signs of it that there's more business throughout the year?
Yes, but we're not even close to being down the road of that journey yet. So, you know, again, the lion's share of our business today still happens in tax season. As we serve more small businesses, those dates extend. Bookkeeping and payroll becomes year-round. Mm-hmm. And clearly the goal for Spruce is to be a year-round financial products business. We're just in the early innings, but that's absolutely the strategy.
That's Jeff Jones, President and CEO of H&R Block. Hear our full conversation with Jeff. You can find that
at Bloomberg.com. Still to come on Bloomberg Business Week, Meta's Mark Zuckerberg has a new strategy convincing you that his multi-billion-dollar social media company is really an underdog.
Facebook is under scrutiny, and it's to its advantage to play up competition. So I think it's important to take it with a grain of salt every time they talk about fear of TikTok and so on.
More on why you shouldn't feel so sorry for Meta. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing. The passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week.
We've often talked about Meta Platforms, the company formerly known as Facebook, getting beaten up by investors, down about 50% this year alone, down from its all-time high back in September of 2021. Well, as Bloomberg Businessweek columnist Max Chafkin writes, despite Mark Zuckerberg's attempt to present Meta as an underdog, Max says it's not time to feel sorry for the social media giant. So let's get to it. This story on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. And Max joining us on the phone from Queens. So Max, why shouldn't we feel sorry for Meta?
So what's happened over this year, basically, is the economy and kind of the social media ecosystem is sort of reverting to pre-COVID norms. So there was this moment, you know, in late 2020 and 2021, people were spending all of their time, you know, on the internet, spending huge sums of money on, you know, online shopping. And that was amazing for Facebook's business and, Meta's business. And what's happened is we've seen a reversion, which has led to, you know, all these kind of like doom and gloom predictions, both from inside the company and from analysts. The thing is, the pre-COVID version of Facebook was still dominant. And when you look at the competitive landscape, yes, TikTok is gaining ground in terms of cultural mind share. They do have a lot of young people on the platform, but it's not even close. Facebook still basically owns social media, and that isn't changing anytime soon. And I think what's happening more is Zuckerberg is attempting to position the company both because it's in this antitrust conversation and as a way to, of course, get more productivity out of his employees to sort of try to find ways, you know, to continue to stay ahead of TikTok.
You know, Max, the other big story, obviously, with Facebook is this pivot to the metaverse, though. Is it possible that is an underdog story? I mean, is Zuckerberg seeing something in the metaverse that everyone else isn't?
Meta, Facebook, already controls a lot of the metaverse. As part of their push into VR, into new platforms, right, they paid around $2 billion for this company called Oculus. That turned into Facebook, Meta's, you know, VR, AR thing. And the question is, how big does this market get, right? Zuckerberg is spending billions of dollars and rebranding the company and so on with the hopes that this is the next big platform, as big as mobile phones or something like that. But we don't actually know that that'll be the case. So in sort of the best case scenario, this becomes huge. It's the biggest PCs. And and that's the vision that Zuckerberg has talked about for years, really. You know, the worst case is Facebook just controls a relatively small market and then continues to dominate social media as it does today.
I mean, it's still a $451 billion market cap company. I mean, it's
not too shabby.
It's exactly. And I think about, there's so many companies when we talk about the law of large numbers. I mean, you're looking at revenue still for this year forecasted to be something like $118 billion. I mean, this company still makes a lot of money.
Well, and one thing that I think people have sort of missed is there's been this conversation like, oh, maybe Meta, Facebook, has lost its cool, right? The young people are going to TikTok. And what it's easy to forget that has been going on for basically a decade. You know, it was about a decade ago that Facebook first lost its cool, maybe a little bit earlier than that. And Zuckerberg has found ways time and again to adjust, you know, and originally that adjustment meant buying Instagram and then copying aspects of Snapchat, buying WhatsApp. And we're seeing that play out again. He can't buy TikTok because of antitrust scrutiny, but he can copy it. And the company is making progress there. It hasn't yet found ways to generate revenue, but these TikTok-like products are definitely gaining in terms of users, time spent, and that sort of thing.
Yeah, Max, I'm wondering, a lot of times when you see a company sort of stumble like this, at least its share price, I would start wondering about the guy at the top. Zuckerberg is both CEO and chairman of the company. Is it just insane to think that there could be some risk to him?
So, I mean, the important thing is he would have to do it, right? He controls Facebook in addition to being the CEO and the chairman through these super voting shares. So he would have to conclude, or I guess suppose like be forced by a court or something, that this would be, you know, better for the company. And I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
So the point is what? That, you know, and I think about as we talk about this story, and you're right, I think I feel like some of the conversations around it is like, oh, woe is, you know, Meta. But I mean, this is a company still, even if numbers maybe, or the growth numbers aren't as strong as they used to be. I mean, when it comes to things like advertising, I mean, this is still where folks go.
Yeah, it's unavoidable from an advertising perspective. And I think it's just worth keeping in mind that there's this political story playing out at the same time, which is that Facebook is under scrutiny and it's to its advantage to play up competition. So I think it's important to, you know, just take it with a grain of salt every time they talk about fear of TikTok and so on.
That was Bloomberg Businessweek columnist Max Chafkin, along with Bloomberg's Mike Regan. You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. Still ahead, how to harness the psychology of social media addiction in a way that can actually help strengthen our minds and bodies.
We only hear about Facebook and right. Snapchat melting kids' brains. We also need to talk about the good examples of how we can actually use habit-forming technology for good.
Yes, for good, especially when it comes to health and wellness. At least so says our next guest. Stick around, we've got more. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Okay, you know, tech startups are always promising to make us better, to help us lose weight, get more sleep, read more. And the reason very few of them actually work is because users never get hooked on them. At least that's according to Nir Eyal, Silicon Valley's habits guy. He's an angel investor, former lecturer at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. He also wrote a couple of books, including Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products. He wrote that back in 2014, and then put out another book in 2020, the title, Indistractable, How to Control Your Attention and Choose Your Life. Bloomberg's Mike Regan and I spoke with Nir in studio this past week, and we had to know, all of this app tracking, information gathering, optimizing, is it really, really good for us?
It's a great question. Is it good? Is it bad? The answer is yes. It's both.
It is. Yeah.
Paul Virilio has a wonderful quote. He said, when we invented the ship, we invented the shipwreck.
That's
so interesting. So, of course, every new technology, especially one on such a massive scale as the internet, is going to have goods and bads about how we manage those.
You know, Nir, I'm wondering about sort of the chemicals that are at play, like the brain chemicals. You know, you always hear about, well, if you get a 10 notifications on your phone, is that a real thing? You know, is there dopamine or whatever, you know, happiness chemicals at work when you get addicted to an app and you're you know, love to see those notifications and stuff like that?
Yes and no. I hate to give a wishy-washy answer, but typically if you hear somebody talk about dopamine squirts, just discount everything they say. After.
Really?
Yeah. Because it's so overused, it's so overplayed. Everything releases dopamine. When you hug somebody, you get dopamine. When you learn to play the piano or play tennis, you get a squirt of dopamine. Dopamine is not cocaine in the brain. It's on a different scale than using an app. So the whole idea of getting addicted to an app or hijacking your brain is so overplayed. If you actually look at the research and you talk to the people who study this stuff, some people get addicted, of course, just like some people get addicted to alcohol, right? Alcohol is highly addictive, but not everybody who has a glass of wine with dinner is an alcoholic, right? About 3 to 5% of the population is addicted, but it's certainly not everyone. Addiction is a pathology, and just because some people get addicted doesn't mean everyone will.
So these little dopamine hits that we get aren't, it's something pretty natural that we'd probably be getting from
Absolutely.
If we see a puppy or something.
Anyway. And we want products to get better. Products being engaging is not a problem, it's progress. Yeah. Right? Are we going to say, hey, Apple, your phones are really easy to use. Stop that. Netflix, your shows, I want to watch them all the time. Can you please make boring shows? It's ridiculous. It's a wonderful thing that the world is becoming more engaging. But the cost of this is that we have to learn some new manners, some new norms, some new ways of being in the world so that we can get the best of these products without letting them get
Hallelujah,
the best of us.
Hallelujah, because I can't imagine, you know, how many times you walk onto like a subway train and like just people are just involved, you know, so engaged either in their phone or something, and you feel kind of rude kind of moving around. And I do feel like we need to kind of rethink how we interact and engage in society as a whole. How do you think about how we could get so much more in the healthcare and wellness space when it comes to apps and, you know, whether it's workable technology? How do you see it? How do you see that it should play out or is playing out?
So we were talking about before we went on air about how I get a gadget almost every week. Somebody sends me something to try out because I'm in this health change space.
Yeah.
And healthcare is specifically taking off. I mean, I think one thing I'm super excited about are continuous glucose monitors. Have you seen those around? It used to be something that only diabetics wore, and it's a game changer. I mean, my mother-in-law is a diabetic.
I have a family member who has
one. You start seeing them on people's arms. What you start seeing now is that people who don't have diabetes are now tracking their glucose because it's so easy to do that now you can track it throughout the day. And there's several companies, I work with a few, that will tell you before you eat, right, before you get a snack, check your glucose. Why? Because it'll tell you whether you are psychologically hungry or physically hungry. And sometimes it's hard for us to tell the difference. So by looking at this app and saying, actually, my blood glucose is fine, I really don't need a snack, let me wait 15 minutes, that can delay snacking. So that's just one small example, but I think we're going to see an explosion of these new behavior change apps.
All right, so what are some of your favorite, you know, either apps or products that are out there, let's say for working out, because there's so many?
Yeah. So one of the apps I talk about in my book, Hooked, is an app called Fitbod, F-I-T-B-O-D. And I love this app because I actually put out a blog post. I was so frustrated with how bad most fitness apps were. I put out a blog post that the title was, Why Your Fitness App Is Making You Fat. Because they were so bad. All of them were so terrible. And then somebody told me about Fitbod. I downloaded it.
Why were they so
it.
Bad? Was it just...
Because they didn't form a habit.
Oh, okay.
Right?
Got it.
And so I downloaded Fitbod and I started using it and I said, oh my goodness, this is actually really great. And it looks like it's following the Hook model. The Hook model is what I based my book on and my class at Stanford on. And so I just went to the customer support email thing and I sent them an email. I said, have you by chance read my book? Within 30 seconds, the founder wrote me back and said, yes, we actually built the Hook model into the app. And it's changed
That's
my life.
That's pretty cool.
I use Fitbod every time I work out. I'm 44 years old, best shape of my life because of this app. It's fantastic.
Well, near cut to the chase here. How can Carol and I make this show more habit-forming?
The most important part, the fuel that we see is the backbone of every habit-forming product is a variable reward, right? Some kind of intermittent reinforcement. And of course, you have it in that you provide the news, the first three letters of news, N-E-W, new. It's all about variability. So that's what makes sports engaging, what makes slot machines so intoxicating, what makes social media fun. It's all about the new, the variability.
Peloton, right? Some were addicted. There's something that really rode a high, no pun intended, and then obviously has come undone a bunch. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a super interesting story because I think it's a great example of why variability is so important for habit formation. That if something is not variable, if it's predictable, it's boring, right? Think about games, right? Everybody wants to gamify everything, put points and badges and leaderboards. But most games... people burn out on, right? Think about, remember Farmville?
Yes.
Farmville was like the biggest thing ever back in, 2012?
Right.
Who's playing Farmville anymore? Nobody. Why? Because after Farmville, it was Chefville and whatever, Frontierville. It was like the same game again
and
again.
You tell me nobody's going to be playing Wordle in a few years?
You may be surprised.
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
As long as you know what's great about Wordle is that it's social.
Yeah.
Or as opposed to solitary experiences like Peloton. So Peloton, during the pandemic, when you couldn't go to the gym, you couldn't do the things that you used to do, it was very novel. It's this screen on your bike. It was so interesting, so
connect with people.
But then you do it 3-4 times, and you kind of got the idea, right? Yeah. It's the same routine. It's not variable enough, let alone the fact that it's hard work, right? You're right. Really pushing yourself. So it's that I think was what went wrong, was that they didn't maintain the sense of variability.
Yeah, you know, Nir, talk to us a little bit about some of the companies you've invested in over the year and how this notion of habit forming had sort of played into your thesis of whether or not a company's worth investing in. If you could give us some examples of,
sure,
of where it worked well.
Yeah, it's been amazing. So the book came out in 2014, Hooked, How to Build Habit-Forming Products, and it's been used in every conceivable industry. Education is one I'm super proud of whenever I see a company using the Hook model. A few years ago, I got a call from these young entrepreneurs in Norway building this little app. They showed me the Hook model. I was so impressed. I immediately said, please take my money. I want in, because they showed me how they really applied the book. And today that company is Kahoot. It's the most widely used educational software in the world. Last time I checked, they had a multi-billion-dollar valuation. And what are they doing? They're getting kids hooked onto online learning.
So how are they doing that? What are some of the techniques?
Yeah, so they have this really innovative. It's like you get the, so the Hook model. I'm trying to summarize a 300-page book in 20 seconds. But essentially, what they're doing is they're getting kids to invest in making these quizzes on their own to share with their peers.
Right.
And so that investment phase, this is really special.
That's great.
Yeah, the investment phase where you put effort into something to make it better.
Right.
So when you are the person making the quiz, right, as opposed to saying that, you know, when we were in school, it was a pop quiz today. That sucks, right? Horrible. Here, the kids are making it for their peers.
Right.
And then in the class, they're playing these quizzes. So anybody with kids, you know, under probably 14, I bet you your kids know all about Kahoot. Yeah. And that's a wonderful example. You know, we only hear about the bad cases. We only hear about Facebook and Snapchat melting kids' brains. I think that story is overblown. But we also need to talk about the good examples of how we can actually use habit-forming technology for good.
You know, Nir, you did sort of flick at the idea of there can be a backlash to products that are too habit-forming, whether it be a parent saying, as you said, the social media is melting my kid brain. Mm-hmm. So how do you sort of assess that risk when you're trying to decide in a company to invest? You know, is that risk still there for, say, the big social media, for the Robin Hoods? You know, how important is that risk, do you think, to these companies going forward?
It's a great question. I spent a lot of time working on ethics. There's actually a chapter in my book called The Morality of Manipulation where I talk about all this. But I propose what I call the regret test. And the regret test comes out of my search for how do you make sure that you're ethical when you use these behavioral design techniques? Because as we talked about, they can be used for good. You can help people exercise more and save money and form all these great habits. But how do you make sure you do it ethically? So the regret test says...
You don't do it with DraftKings or one of the gambling apps, I assume.
That's a great example.
Robinhood?
Also potentially a great example. So the regret test says that it asks, would the user do what we have designed for them to do, knowing everything we know? Summarized as, would they regret using our product?
Mm-hmm.
Because people aren't dumb, right? People aren't dumb. That if they regret doing business with you, guess what? Not only are they not going to do business with you, they're going to tell all their friends on social media not to do business with you.
Yes, indeed. Nothing like the power of a bad online review. That was Nir Eyal, angel investor, author, and Silicon Valley's habits guy. And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser. Many thanks to Bloomberg News senior markets reporter Katie Greifeld and Bloomberg Markets senior editor Mike Regan for joining us as well over the past week. Be sure to tune into Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday starting at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio. Catch us too on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News. And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can catch our full conversations with so many of our guests. Find that at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and always on the Bloomberg Terminal. Have a good weekend, everyone. Stay safe and sound. This is Bloomberg.